From the studios of KXAM, welcome to Tell the Truth Faster, hosted by Stuart Altshuler, marriage and family therapist. Stay tuned and learn how you can open your mind and soul to new possibilities in life. Now here's your host, Stuart Altshuler.
Welcome to Tell the Truth Faster. This is Stuart Altshuler. I'm a licensed psychotherapist, and this is a show where we deal with mental health issues every week from a holistic perspective, which means a balance in body, mind, and spirit. And we all know that the truth will set you free, but the question we ask here is, how long are you willing to keep freedom on hold? And that's what we deal with every week. How do you find freedom in your life, freedom from the demons within you, freedom from the restrictiveness that your mind creates, all our minds create in terms of judgment, in terms of fear, and freedom from fear. And in doing so, being able to move into a place that is more joyful, balanced, and alive. Now, before we get into today's show, I want to acknowledge my sponsor, Rainbow Mobile Notary Services. Now, as a nation, we all recently witnessed the unfortunate events and circumstances surrounding the Terri Schiavo case. Each day, hundreds of individuals face difficult, life-altering decisions like that and are not properly prepared. Don't let this happen to you. Let Rainbow Mobile Notary Services help. We all tend to avoid stressful, emotional, physical, and financial charged issues and convince ourselves it's never going to happen to me or I have plenty of time to deal with this. For your own peace of mind and for the well-being of those you love, don't wait or procrastinate. Let Rainbow Mobile Notary Services assist you with living wills, trusts, estate planning, and particularly medical power of attorneys and much more. Plan now. Prevent problems later. Mobile Notary Services will come to your home, your office, even a hospital room, to notarize signatures necessary to give all of you peace of mind on these power of attorneys or any other papers that you need to deal with. So if you want to get in touch with them, which I urge you to do so you're not in that same predicament at all, have some peace of mind by taking care of those things now before you need them, call Rainbow Mobile Notary Services at area code 480-518-2090. That's 480-518-2090. Or you can visit their website at www.rainbowprof.com. That's rainbowprof as in professional.com. rainbowprof.com. So I want to thank them for the support of the show and encourage all of you to make use of their services. Now, Tell the Truth Faster. We're going to be doing a show today that some of you may think you might have seen on a Jerry Springer show or some of these really crazy type of talk shows where it's really about insanity. But what we're going to be talking about today actually is the search for sanity, the search for balance. So the title of today's show is Living in Two Worlds, The Life of a Crossdresser. And my guest today actually has been on the show. He was actually on the show back in September of 2002. And he's a psychiatrist named Dr. Richard Novick. And he's able to speak from the psychiatric issues, from the scientific issues, but also from a very personal place because he himself is a cross-dresser, and he has a private practice in psychotherapy and psychopharmacology and deals with a wide range of clientele, including transgendered, gay, lesbian, bisexual people. And he is married with kids and has a full life speaking his truth and living his truth with the support of his wife and friends. And I want to start by welcoming Dr. Richard Novick to the show today. Are you there, Richard?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Stuart. And you know, a big hello to everybody out there in Arizona.
Well, I'm glad you joined us today again. I know that we did actually a very good show a couple of years ago, but the reason for the show today is, first of all, this is an issue that I think is important to hear, not just for, well, for on two levels, actually. First of all, because of all of the prejudice and misunderstandings about this, it's about helping to bring some understanding from someone who really knows what he's talking about and not just putting on some kind of, you know, hype and scene to help the community at large. But also there will be people out there listening who may be struggling with this issue themselves. So my goal in doing the show again with you, now that you have your book out called Alice in Genderland, is to maybe touch some people who are struggling with this, and maybe by the end of the show they may not feel so alone, which I know is something you felt growing up.
Absolutely. And, you know, I wrote Alice in Genderland to really give us cross-dressers a voice. It's the first modern-day cross-dressing memoir written.
And I think that's the key. It's a memoir. It's not a book about cross-dressers. This is actually your story.
Yes, this is my personal story, you know, from growing up back in Cleveland, Ohio, to, you know, being a psychiatrist today with, you know, a full family life and professional life. And I really felt that all too often, you know, cross-dressers make up, by some estimates, about 3% of the male population.
Mm-hmm.
And all too often, it's always outsiders who are, you know, who are telling the world about us and presenting us and characterizing us. And it's very rare, because most of us live and lead such hidden lives. It's very rare that we really get a chance to say, you know, this is the kind of person I am, and these are the struggles and the triumphs that I've experienced in life. So that, you know, that really was what I felt was really important when I sat down to write Alice in Genderland.
Well, and also, I think it's important to make a point that most people are not aware of, and that is the vast majority of cross-dressers are not gay men. Is that true?
Right. Well, very true. In fact, you know, in fact, cross-dresser is almost by the way we define the term. You know, cross-dresser isn't just any male who puts on a dress, but it's really really a man who is turned on by it and enjoys it, and, you know, really enjoys it so much that he would like to do it again and again.
Mm-hmm.
So
there's actually an identification with it and an emotional connection to the experience is what you're saying, I think.
Absolutely. It's a very emotionally and sexually satisfying experience.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, by that, and now also, I mean, that, I guess that kind of defines what a cross-dresser is, who a cross-dresser is. And as it turns out, that if we look at cross-dressers, you know, as defined that way, you know, it ends up that 95, perhaps even 100%, are heterosexual men.
Mm-hmm.
Heterosexual in the sense that the cross-dressers really, really prefer women.
Mm-hmm.
We may not be only excited about women, but generally speaking, we prefer women. Most of us are married men or men that have had, you know, many satisfying relationships with women over the years. Perhaps have experimented with men also. Some of us, you know, really further develop that side of our sexuality, like I have. But predominantly, cross-dressers prefer women, and if, you know, and are often confused with gay men who enjoy cross-dressing, who enjoy dressing up. And, you know, a gay man who likes to do it frequently would be known as a drag queen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just defined a different way. It's a different group of people, but group of people that don't tend to lead as closeted lives as cross-dressers, and therefore, mm-hmm. whenever the average person thinks of a man in a dress, the average person thinks of a drag queen.
Well, how many of these heterosexual guys that are having these feelings about wanting to dress as women automatically assume that that must mean they're gay, and adds a whole nother level of problems and stress and shame and guilt and all this other stuff, even though, like you say, their primary erotic attraction is women, but they're working under the assumption, I think, because of what society usually says, that if you want to dress like a woman, you're a gay man. So they end up trying this and focusing on that. Does that happen often with cross-dressers?
Well, you know, it sure does. And, I remember when I was a teenager and was discovering how excited I was about women's clothes. And, it really felt like I was getting pretty worked up and excited about something that was very, very not straight. And so, I feared that I might be gay and really was confused, because here I was, let's say, enjoying some experimentation with, in my sister's lingerie drawer.
Yeah, you describe that quite a bit in the book, so.
Yeah. But at the same time, only aware of just powerful sexual attraction to women and not really much at all to men. And it was very confusing in that way. Very mm-hmm. confusing.
Well, there's actually a paragraph I want to read from the early part of the book, and I think it addresses some of what we're talking about here. Naturally, from day one, my parents expected me to act like a boy and encouraged me to act like a boy. And I, being more inclined towards blocks and records than dolls and tea parties, did not disappoint them. Yet, much to my chagrin, a trickle of girlish thoughts began to cross my mind when I was 4 years old and developed my own version of that charming game, Step on a Crack, Break Your Mother's Back. For me, though, stepping on a crack wouldn't break my mother's back, it would turn me into a girl. Although one part of me had clearly chosen my own special consequence of stepping on a crack, another part recoiled in horror at the mere thought of suffering such a fate. Still, I couldn't keep from playing this game each time I noticed a crack in the sidewalk. Now, you're talking about 4 years old.
Yes. Definitely.
So it's like, as a gay man, I could say I knew that there was some feelings and differences about me. My memory takes me back to probably 5 or 6. So this is no different, really, in terms of a knowingness that happens very early on. And how did you deal with it as a child? I mean, how did that affect you even before puberty?
Well, I think that what happened really, like with stepping on a crack and fearing getting turned into a girl because of that, that's something that I didn't really recognize the significance until years later and looking back in retrospect.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that especially as a young child. Before puberty, I really did my best to stay blissfully oblivious. And when funny little things would come up, like when I was out raking the leaves in the yard with my father and, complaining about how I had to do all the outdoor work and my sisters and me split up all the indoor work between the four of us, I complained to my father about my unfair lot. As a boy in the house, and he said, "Well, what would you like us to do? Dress you up in a sweater and skirt like your sisters and march you off to school like that?" And, I was only 9 years old at the time, but I found that idea a little uncomfortably exciting. There was just a tickle in the back of my mind that was like, ooh, that sounds pretty stimulating
right.
in a way. And But the thing is, though, I readily, whatever that tickle in the back of my mind was, I tuned it out fast and moved on to thinking about other things.
Right.
And so I guess I learned to ignore some of my feelings and some of my, you know, some of my associations and daydreams and things like that. I learned a way to be a little detached and tuned out, unfortunately.
Well, I think that's a coping mechanism that people use for all sorts of things that they don't know how to deal with and don't feel much support from their family or peers or anything like that. We go into denial. We repress the feelings. You know, no matter what the urge is, you know, for most children and many adults, it's that kind of let's ignore the truth because I don't know what to do with it anyway.
Exactly.
You know, so, you know, that seems to me like a very normal coping mechanism, especially for a child who had no idea what these feelings are really about. He only knew that if people knew about it, it would be uncomfortable and maybe
right.
Shameful.
It downright disgraceful, really.
Yeah.
You know, for a young boy, for somebody who's, you know, starting to find his manhood and assert his manhood, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think it's important to keep talking about childhood and adolescence because the people listening, and I remind people that if this is a live show, so if you want to call in and ask a question or talk about your own experience or make some comments, the number is 480-949-1310. That's Arizona, Phoenix, Arizona, 480-949-1310. And it's the same number if you're listening outside Phoenix on the Internet, 480-949-1310. So getting back to dealing with what it was like to be a kid and a teenager, now you were a boy like most boys. You played sports. I think you played soccer, and you were good in school, and you know, you had friends. I think you described yourself a little bit more like slender and geeky in the book, but you seem to have an interest in things that would be considered boyish enough to get by.
You know, I was a real good soccer player. I played on the Cleveland All-Star team at the age of 15 and 16 and was captain of varsity soccer. I got very involved. I grew up with a fair amount of privilege and was very involved with yacht racing and was a pretty good four-deck man and stuff like that. And you know, a pretty good all-around student, maybe especially good in math and science. So, I really was outwardly very much a young man.
Mm-hmm. And so even through adolescence, you know, this was something you were able to hide. I know in your book you describe kind of progressing from, you know, trying on a pair of your sister's panties under the cover one time and to kind of moving into when you were home alone, going up to her room, and at a certain point, I think at age 17, you were home alone for a while and put on the bra and the skirt and everything else for the first time.
I guess I did. You know, I think the problem for me occurred really when I was 17 years old, and I hope I can say this on radio. I first tried to masturbate, you
mm-hmm.
know, and I found that I really couldn't reach orgasm without imagining for a moment that I was a woman.
And
you know, all the defenses that I used up until that time were not enough. I could not just plain ignore that fact.
Mm-hmm.
It was a pretty strange fact that I, you know, it was going to take a lot more to shrug that off than just ignoring it.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, so I had to build some, you know, some new defense mechanisms to protect me from the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I told myself things like, well, you know, I know that I really, really love women, and this whole masturbation thing, there's something not quite right with it anyways, so that once I have a loving girlfriend and a regular sex life, anything connected with masturbation isn't going to matter anyways.
Right.
So this is still, it's weird, it's troubling, but it's inconsequential. You know, the other thing I told me was, you know, we men and women, you know, we're both part of the same species. We're both human beings, even though we no doubt live pretty different lives. And wouldn't anybody be fascinated? Wouldn't any man be fascinated to know, like, some of the little daily nitty-gritties of what it's like to be a woman and vice versa?
Mm-hmm.
So I figured, how am I different from any other curious person with an imagination?
Well, how are you different? You know, I mean, I know what you're saying is, no, you're not really different than any other person with their own fantasies and imagination that go in whatever direction they go in. I mean, another paragraph you have here that I underlined, why does one's sense of self so often start with sexual fantasies or experiences? Why do so many cross-dressers and transsexuals start out with centerfold fantasies and lingerie rather than a sense of female identity? Why do so many gay and bi men begin with locker room fantasies and furtive encounters rather than love for another man? Maybe it's because a scared teenager, can keep himself blind to the deeper truth, but can't avoid the simple things he needs if he ever hopes to achieve an orgasm. You know, so basically you're saying that sooner or later the truth will win out.
Yeah.
For most people. And if
yeah.
it doesn't,
yeah.
and that's the whole theme of the show all the time, if you don't let the truth win out in your life, it will end up getting you sick or into addictions or other things like that that, you know, have to show up at a certain point, because your body and your psyche can take the repression of that truth just so long.
Exactly, and very often our sexual drive, our sexual energy and fantasies are the lead edge of the wedge that pushes through those defenses that are saying, repress this, ignore this, write it off in one way or another. That a lot of times, especially for those of us who, you know, for males, that puberty and testosterone just invigorates, you know, certain inner feelings to the point that they start to break through some of the old ways of coping.
Now, to put this in a little bit of perspective, I've told this story on the air before, and I may even told it when you were on the show the last time. You know, as a gay man, I've had a lot of people, including my brother, ask me, you know, when he found out that I was gay, you know, well, does that mean you get dressed up in women's clothes and all this other stuff? And, you know, I mean, this is going back many years. You know, he had no understanding of it. And the truth is, I've never really had an inclination or desire to dress as a woman. But there was one time that I did, and it was, you know, the excuse most men, gay or straight, usually use, which is Halloween. And I was invited to a party. There's a comic many of you may know called Terry Sweeney. He used to be on Saturday Night Live, and he did the drag version of Nancy Reagan on the show, and he's just great. And so he and his lover were having a Halloween party, but the condition was we all had to show up as middle-aged housewives. And he invited, you know, all men, all friends and stuff, and it was a Tupperware party. We all had to bring a covered dish. It was really a lot of fun, but it kind of panicked me. You know, it's like, oh, my God, you know, I don't know where to start, and I don't know how I'm going to feel doing this and stuff. But some friends of mine, one who's a hairdresser and has, you know, done theatrical drag and stuff, I said, I'm in your hands. And so to make a long story short, he did my hair, my makeup. You know, I borrowed a dress from someone who was my size in terms of another drag queen, and went to this party. And I decided myself that if I'm going to do this, I'm not going to do what a lot of gay men do, which is be a caricature of a woman. If I'm going to do this, I'm going to honor the womanhood inside me, so to speak. It really became kind of a almost therapeutic experience for me. And I went to this party knowing most of the people there. And you know how when you're in costume, you usually can go, oh, George, that's you. You know, it's a great costume type of thing. Well, I was at that party for over a half an hour and actually sat next to a friend of mine named Ron talking to him for like 15 minutes before all of a sudden he freaked out because he realized it was me he was talking to.
How about that?
And all of them were going, this is scary, Stuart. You're just too comfortable and too natural in this. And it was like my intention of actually honoring that part of me, that I allowed myself to relax into the experience and actually enjoy it and learn something from it. But there was no desire to ever do it again. I mean, it's not like I'd be adverse to it, but it wasn't something that all of a sudden triggered something in me to say, oh, you know, I found my calling, or this is something I really like doing.
Or forget 18 holes of golf each weekend. I want to do this each weekend.
Right. So it's kind of like, you know, the whole experience of, you know, cross-dressing for an evening as opposed to it being something so much a part of who you are, I think is an important distinction to make. And that's what your whole book is about. I mean, you know, if we move ahead a little bit here, you know, I know this whole book is about you personally, so I don't mind asking you personal questions. Now, you're a psychiatrist, and you've been in practice for a long time, and I'm assuming at a certain point you yourself went into therapy.
Certainly.
And how was it talking to the therapist the first time? When was that?
Well,
I mean, were you already in medical school, or were you getting therapy before then?
You know, that was medical school. That was really my last year of medical school and internship.
Mm-hmm.
And, it was a complicated situation because I had actually experimented sexually with a man at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And was very much panicked about the chance that I could have become HIV positive.
Uh-huh.
Which would have been a big problem both for me and to my fiancé at the time.
your future wife?
Yes.
Okay.
So I initially sought this particular psychoanalyst's help to deal with the panic over HIV and the confusion caused by this experience that I had experimenting with a man. And but once my test results came back HIV negative, and I was and the smoke started to clear at home between me and my wife, I was able to then really admit to the cross-dressing, this whole, I really enjoy imagining that I'm a woman for a while thing that had been going on, you know, since the age of 4 or essentially forever for me. Really at that point it felt like confess to this curse, this disease that I had, and ask this therapist for help.
What was the therapist's reaction? Were you lucky enough to be with someone who didn't end up making matters worse?
Well, I think that, unfortunately, no.
Okay. All right.
You know, I think that as a cross-dresser, I consider myself a transgendered person and part of the whole gay, lesbian, bi, trans community. And we GLBT people have to be very careful about the therapists that we see, because some therapists are inclined to look at us all as perverts in need of, you know, treatment for who we are, to try to change it, if that's indeed possible, which it doesn't seem. To change it because a lot of therapists and a lot of our mainstream culture still thinks that these are bad types of people to be.
Mm-hmm.
That gay, lesbian, bi, or transgendered are just bad things to be. So, you know, I wasn't able to carefully find a therapist who would be particularly informed when it came to cross-dressing, you know, or transgender issues, to be either particularly informed or particularly sympathetic. So I ended up really confessing to what felt to me at the time all these horrible things that I had done with women's underwear and, you know, having sex with a man. And
the key word there, confessing.
Yes.
right.
passing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he just was quiet as a stone in return. And I could just feel the scorn that he would have for me. You know, that I, well, that at least I would expect from any of the guys that I went to high school or college with, you know, the kind of the scorn that I would have expected from any straight man. And, you know, whether this guy felt that kind of scorn, that kind of, oh, you know, Novick, you're pathetic, you know, looking at me, whether he actually felt that or not, he didn't open up his mind, his mouth, and give me the benefit of hearing that he might have been able to put this together in a different way and therefore start helping me put it together in a way that says, you know, this doesn't have to be a curse.
Mm-hmm.
This is kind of wonderful in its way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you being a cross-dresser, you know, being a fascinating mix of masculinity and femininity is what, you know, makes our makes human society diverse and puts new ideas out there.
Mm-hmm.
And
that certainly know, would have been the enlightened thing to say.
Yeah.
What year was that?
This was in 1990.
Okay.
You know.
So it was actually at a point where the gay and lesbian community was getting a lot of press particularly because of the AIDS epidemic in 19, you know, in the 80s and 90s, but this was still an area which is, you know, transgender, which people, even therapists, still didn't have that much insight and awareness of.
And that, you know, that's still true today, really. I mean, in the, you know, they're just the cross-dressers and transsexuals, you know, the transgender population, we're really a relatively small group of people. And so there isn't a lot of awareness about us. And certainly in different cities, you know, the average mental health person doesn't really know a great deal about us.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always best if you happen to be a transgender person to not just, you know, plain see anybody for your mental health, but to really try to get a good referral from either a transgendered friend or a transgendered organization, which
right.
could reach through the internet or, you know, or something like that.
And in this day and age, there are plenty of websites people can go to for those referrals. You know, I mean, you still have to be careful on the internet that you're not ending up on a website that's really going to be damaging and judgmental. You know,
right.
when, as you were talking, I just had this memory flash go through me from when I was a kid, and my mother had this hairdresser whose name was Stuart also. And I remember her coming home one day from the hairdresser with this stack of photographs that she borrowed from him, and basically they were pictures of Stuart and his mother helping Stuart get dressed in drag. And my mother thought this was the most amazing thing, and it's like, Mom, if you only knew what was going inside of your son here, you know, I mean, to me, I identified that with gay, not as cross-dressing, you know, as a kid.
Sure.
So it's kind of like, here's my mom. I mean, she wasn't making fun of it. She was actually, you know, like, isn't this cute type of thing, you know? Of course, she had difficulty with me being gay, and it wasn't so cute then, years later.
Cute on somebody else.
Yeah. But it was interesting how we're talking about that memory having come back to me in a long time, and it was such a significant experience for me internally, you know, in a sense of, you know, almost feeling naked when she was talking about Stuart and those pictures and his mother and him getting dressed as a woman.
How about that? Well, you know, I'll tell you something else interesting about, you know, your experience at that Halloween party, dressing up as a woman and having a friend, you know, having it be so natural that a friend didn't even know it was you for,
mm-hmm.
You know, for a half hour or however long it was. You know, that for most cross-dressers, you know, most of us, you know, of course, coming from the straight segment of life, you know, the straight population, for most of us, the original experience cross-dressing is very much the opposite of yours, in the sense that where you were natural and relatively at ease with it, most of us are awful at it. we don't have that natural ease and grace with the feminine part of ourselves, and that gay men, especially gay men who, you know, who've gotten comfortable with themselves, can flow into drag and pull it off with a certain ease and style that we folks who come from the straight world, we really struggle with and are very clumsy in our skirts and our high heels for quite a while.
Well, even in your book, you talked about having to get your intonations down in your speech and the tone of your voice and the phrasing that you use and the mannerisms and things like that, that they actually became things that you tried on to see what worked for you and what didn't.
Yeah, you know, I really had to, I and truly any cross-dresser or many transsexuals who are being honest with you have to learn femininity as a second language.
Mm-hmm.
So I really, really studied it. Mm-hmm. You know, how should I walk? How should I say it? What should I say in this situation? How should I say it? How is she saying it? Could I mimic that? Could I learn
right.
that? You know, a whole study of the art of being female beyond what anybody ever sort of talks about. I mean, there's a lot to it. If it doesn't flow naturally from you, there's a lot to it.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's kind of the difference between, I said earlier, between this natural expression of that aspect of all men who have a female aspect to them, and the caricature that a lot of drag queens put on, you know, the big hair and the big mannerisms and the overly sexy type of behaviors and, you know, if you're being Joan Crawford, you're more than Joan Crawford type of thing. So it becomes more theatrical and over the top. I mean, we live in a society where, you know, I watched the movie Stage Beauty recently for the first time, where in Shakespeare's time, men had to play the female parts. So it was, they were actually honored professionals in their field. Last night I couldn't sleep, and on, I think, Nick at Night or one of them, I watched an episode of Bosom Buddies where Tom Hanks and Peter Scolari were in drag on the show, and of course everybody thought it was great. Milton Berle, I mean, Eddie Murphy actually did some drag stuff. I mean, it's part of our theatrical sensibilities that we can laugh at, and yet, when it comes to the humanity of it, people are truly not, they're laughing at it and criticizing it and judging it. So, you know, it must be, I can only imagine what it must be like to see all this going on around you, and just like those photos that my mother was showing me, you know, when, if you're still in the closet, so to speak, you know, with this aspect of you, and yet seeing all this on stage and in films and everything else, how does that impact somebody who's still struggling and secretly feeling these things?
Well, you know, I think that seeing men dress up as women and take it over the top, you know, like being very, very much Joan Crawford, you know, I don't, at least for me, that didn't hurt so much. In fact, I kind of enjoyed seeing that type of thing because at least it's better than a lot of the other portrayals that that transgender people were getting. You know, a couple of the things that really hit me very, very hard were, one was when I was in college, I was really, you know, struggling with the fact that deep down I knew I was turned on by women's clothing. And I saw Brian De Palma's Dress to Kill,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, this cross-dressing, actually psychiatrist, just like me.
Right.
is a serial killer, of all things.
Uh-huh.
And you know what? I really hadn't seen a cross-dresser portrayed in any sort of film or story or anything. And then all of a sudden, the first one that I see is this really creepy, highly suspect, deeply evil, very pathetic serial killer. Thank you, Brian De Palma.
Right.
You know, I was bound and determined not to be that kind of person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was going to fight this thing to the death, even if it took suicide, you know, so that I didn't become, you know, a cross-dressing psychiatrist.
Uh-huh.
Serial killer, at least, first. you know, and so just the fact that there would be other, you know, sort of men in drag that were sort of Milton Berle type, everybody gets a good, healthy laugh, that was refreshing to me. It was like, well, you know, so
okay.
I'm not a totally hideous person here. I'm just a laughing stock.
Okay.
You know what I mean? So,
yes, I do.
That's how bad things were at that, you know, at that point. And, of course, you know, Silence of the Lambs was, you know, the everybody remembers Hannibal Lecter, fortunately, but the, you know, the main serial killer that Hannibal was helping Jodie Foster
right.
Hunt down was a frustrated transsexual.
Right.
Who was murdered. So, I mean, so you know, with stuff like that out there, laughingstock was refreshing.
Okay, good. Now, we have about 12 minutes, 13 minutes left, and we cannot do the show because we've mentioned that you married a couple of times.
Yeah.
So let's talk about how this fits in, how this part of you fits into your relationship with your wife, how you're able to express it. I know you have two kids.
I have two kids.
Two kids. And how old are the kids?
You know, my kids are 4 and 6.
Okay. Have they ever seen you, daddy, dressed up as a woman?
Well, you know, I used to actually give my son a bottle sometimes when I was dressed up and, you know, before I was on my way out to meet a friend for dinner or something
uh-huh.
like that. You know, but that was back when he was an infant.
Infant, yeah.
But, you know, my wife and I decided to not tell them about my cross-dressing until later on, after they get a chance to kind of learn what is normally expected of men and women, and
mm-hmm.
they start to feel kind of comfortable with who they are.
Yeah, when they're a bit more mature.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, so you have a wife. Mm-hmm. How does it work in terms of, my understanding is like one night a week is your night to go out.
Exactly.
As Alice.
Yeah.
Okay, so Alice gets to go out one night a week. The rest of the week, you're Rick and
yep.
dad and husband and psychiatrist. So your wife's okay with that?
Yeah, she's okay with that.
How'd she get there?
Well,
that's,
you know,
that's the question on most people's minds, I think. I think a lot of people probably are wishing that I was interviewing her also, because I think a lot of people would have questions. How does... You know, I mean, I've known gay men who stay in marriages after the wives find out about it, and they're able to work that through. How'd your wife come to terms with this, and how supportive is she?
Well, you know, she, you know, I have to say, first of all, that she's not the the original wife that that I was engaged to when I first experimented with a man, and all hell broke loose as I entered therapy and stuff like that. You know, I ended up getting divorced and, you know, getting very comfortable with, you know, being a cross-dresser, being, as I see it, part woman inside.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just plain decided I'm not going to get together with anybody, male or female.
So this is actually your second marriage. Did your first wife actually know about the cross-dressing?
Eventually I told her. And, you know, she was not happy about it at all, and you know, would have placed some pretty strict limits on it. But you know, in the process of it all, I just decided that she wasn't the right person for me, and I actually ended up leaving her.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, being single for a while and deciding that I really still preferred women and prefer to, you know, share my life with a woman, but that I certainly wasn't going to do that without letting someone know that that I was a cross-dresser right up front,
mm-hmm.
which is what I did the second time around. And basically, you know, I met Melissa back in 93 or something like that, and we took it step by step. So I had a sense of what my needs might be, the woman part of me might need in terms
mm-hmm.
of how often I would want and need to go out as a woman, and what was really important for me to be able to do, whether that was shopping or dining or dancing, or ultimately even, you know, being able to be involved with a man. And
As a woman. Mm-hmm.
And, eventually Melissa and I worked out, we worked out an agreement that I could have a relationship on the side with a man as long as I only saw him on that one night a week, that I would be out, you know, expressing myself as a woman. And that,
in other words, she was okay with Alice having a relationship, but not Rick having another relationship.
Exactly. Alice
right.
could have a relationship, and that relationship couldn't start to become Rick's boyfriend as well and start stealing Rick away from Melissa.
But from what I see in your book, there's really no desire on your part to be with the boyfriend as Rick.
Very true.
Okay.
You know, there isn't, nor on Frank's part to be with Alice as Rick. I mean, to have me be Rick. So Frank
right.
doesn't want to be with Rick either. So
he wants to be
works.
With Alice, and yeah.
It kind of works.
Uh huh.
And you know, I've now been with Melissa for like 12 years,
mm-hmm.
and I've been with Frank for over five years.
Okay. So basically, Alice is monogamous and Rick is monogamous.
You know, exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly right. And, you know, it certainly feels, especially for somebody like me who has been involved with so many things that are sexual and taboo, that it feels refreshingly virtuous to,
mm-hmm.
to have been so monogamous for so long. But, I certainly have resisted temptations here or there, but fundamentally, I'm not that wild of a person. I'm somebody who really feels close to a certain small, a certain handful of people, and I like to stick by the people that I'm comfortable with and who I care about and who I know care about me. And even though as a cross-dresser, I'm a man, but also really half a woman inside, and that makes things a little more complicated still. You know, it ends up for me just being about finding a handful of people that I want to, go through life with and sticking by them.
Mm-hmm. Now, does Melissa's your wife's name?
Mm-hmm.
Does Melissa have a relationship with Alice at all?
Well, when we were starting out,
have the girls ever gone out together?
Together,
shopping together, or for lunch, or anything like that.
Well, when we were starting out, Melissa really helped me a lot with hair and makeup and putting clothes together and things like that. And we would have these great adventures to nearby cities where nobody knew us, and
uh-huh.
we would sneak out of a motel room and go to restaurants and nightclubs and stuff like that, and. So we had fun going out as girls,
mm-hmm.
and we took it back into the bedroom a little bit, just as some sort of fun, something different to try.
Okay. So basically, Melissa tried lesbianism for a bit.
You could call it that.
Okay. I mean, you know what we need? To me, it's about using words that describe the image.
Okay.
Even though, you know, there's a whole different dynamic that I know is going on between the two of you, but, you know, that's how the image gets described in my mind.
Yeah, you know, so, and it's a good image, you know. So we did a fair amount of that type of stuff early on. But then ultimately, you know, Melissa and I figured that it was going to be better for me to go out alone as a woman, and you know, because Melissa was really more of a good sport and very tolerant with all this,
mm-hmm.
but not into it herself.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I, you know, really like to let my hair down and really be a woman, which means, you know, flirting with men and you know, holding hands and stuff like that, which really was not so cool to be doing right in front of Melissa.
Right.
So, you know, it wasn't great. It ultimately wasn't great for her, and it cramped my style a lot. And so she just said, "Hey, you know, do what you need to do on your night out a week. I feel pretty secure in my relationship with you, and you know, vice versa. You know, we're best friends and very committed to each other, and we're each other's family. And you know, we have a really good sense that neither's going anywhere. So we're able to allow." You know, special privileges that aren't allowed in most marriages or long-term committed relationships.
Right. And you and Melissa are still sexually active yourselves with each other, and there's still the passion and lustfulness going on in that relationship as husband and wife.
You know, yes, both of us in our 40s now, I'm very pleased to report, yes.
Uh-huh. So in other words, what I'm hearing is Alice does not take away from you and Melissa. In fact, what I'm hearing, I think, is the more Melissa embraced and supported Alice's existence, the more comfort and peace that seemed to grow within the intimacy with you and Melissa.
Absolutely. You know, because I felt, for the first time in my life, really,
mm-hmm.
fully accepted and loved.
Yeah.
You know?
Now, we only have a couple of minutes left, but I really had wanted to get into that part about what's going on currently with you. Is there anything, how can people find a copy of your book, and any final words before I do my closing here?
Well, let's see. You know, I think that anybody out there who, that really, people should realize that as cross-dressers, we make up about 3% of the male population, and you know, there really are a few of us in everybody's family, in everybody's high school or college class, you know, in everybody's apartment building. And you know, if you're curious to learn what the life of a crossdresser is like, you know, viewed from the inside, you know, really all the truth told, or if you're curious to know, you know, if you're a male, what it would be like to be, you know, going out on a regular basis and living part of your life as a woman, you know, or vice versa, if you're a woman, you know, who's curious about what it would be like to have a lot of your life and a lot of your experiences as a man, check out Alice in Genderland, A Crossdresser Comes of Age. That's what my book is called,
mm-hmm.
Alice in Genderland, Genderland. It's available at Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com, and really all major online bookstores.
Right. And if they didn't write it down, they could go to TellTheTruthFaster.com, and you can find the name of the book and Dr. Richard Novick right there. And there's actually a hyperlink to a website, actually, that's CrossDresser.com. Okay?
Great.
So I know we need to end here. Dr. Novick, I really want to thank you for being on the show and how honest and open you've been, and hopefully we've touched some people's lives here today. So thanks again for taking the time on your Saturday. And I want to thank all of you for listening. I want to thank Rainbow Mobile Notary Services for their sponsorship. And I'll be back next week, same time, same place, on KXAM 1310. Thanks for listening. Thank you.
that I heard of once in a lullaby.